Assessing Revolutionary and Insurgent Strategies. Undergrounds in Insurgent, Revolutionary, and Resistance Warfare. Chapter 1. Leadership and Organization. Introduction. It is at once obvious that the most fundamental element of an insurgent underground is its organization and the leadership that guides it. TC 1801 notes that insurgencies require leadership to provide vision, direction, guidance, coordination, and organizational coherence. Stated differently, leaders form movements, provide them with an ideological direction, recruit members, and organize these members to achieve the movement's goals. The movement's goals and the overall operating environment determine the organization of the movement. Hence, in order to understand an insurgent underground, a necessary first step is to comprehend the nature of its organization and its leadership. The companion to this work, the second edition of Human Factors: Considerations of Undergrounds in Insurgencies, deals with how insurgent leaders emerge and focuses on their psychology and sociological development. This work, conversely, looks at the structure and functions of organizations and the functionality of leadership. The primary factor that determines the organization of an insurgency and its underground is the goal of the movement. In large part, this goal is defined by the ideology of the movement, so this chapter will begin by discussing the role of ideology. It should be noted, however, that many insurgencies, with the possible exception of communist movements, are started by individuals who lack prior experience with designing and leading a movement, resulting in an initial organizational structure that will likely evolve as these leaders gain experience and as the resource and security aspects of the movement change. Ideology. The crucial role of ideology in an insurgent or resistant movement cannot be overstated. An ideology grows out of discontent with the status quo. It is the intangible idea that gives rise to acts of defiance and rebellion. Ideology also plays a dual role in an insurgency in that it serves as the basis for recruitment and it illuminates strategic direction. These observations seem obvious. What is not so obvious is the decisive role leaders assume as they cultivate, develop, and evolve ideology during the course of an insurgency. Their decisions and motivations regarding the specific ideological principles of the movement, political, economic, cultural, or religious, are anything but academic. Rather, they serve to characterize the movement's ability to appeal to the masses, and they both energize and, in many cases, constrain the progress of the movement's strategy. A key principle for understanding modern insurgent, resistance, and revolutionary movements is that ideology evolves. It is rare for a movement's ideology to remain unchanged throughout the course of the struggle. An insurgency's ideology moves along a spectrum of exclusivity and inclusivity as leaders stake out the movement's position on politics, religion, social justice, etc. Exclusive ideologies aim at energizing a targeted sector of the population, helping the members of that population to define themselves in relation to the foes they oppose. Inclusive ideologies, conversely, seek to unify various groups and encourage them to coalesce around the insurgency's main goal. Exclusive ideologies have the advantage of facilitating strategic focus because they tend to embrace very specific and dramatic goals. The disadvantage of exclusivity, however, is that the ideology does not appeal to a broad sector of the population. Inclusive ideologies tend to embrace large portions of the population, but they suffer from multiple, vague, and often conflicting goals that make strategic focus problematic. Yasser Arafat's leadership of Fatah and later the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, illustrates both the strengths and weaknesses of an inclusive approach to ideology. The most fundamental goal of the PLO was the destruction of Israel, so that displaced Palestinians could return to their homeland. Beyond that single point of congruity, however, there were many competing ideas within the movement. Pan-Arabists viewed the unification of Arabs as the key to achieving the overall goal, the destruction of Israel, and agitated for the PLO to subordinate itself to the Arab leaders of surrounding states, primarily Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser. Communists insisted that the entire Palestinian conflict was a manifestation of the universal struggle against capitalism and imperialism. Islamists interpreted the conflict in theological and eschatological terms and pushed for religious revival as the means to victory. Confronted with these and other disparate ideas, Arafat welcomed them all, at least initially. He deftly courted the various subgroups and factions that would ultimately compose the PLO, but nurtured a singular focus on destroying the hated Israeli foe. Arafat's inclusive ideology had utility because it allowed the PLO to adapt to these new, vigorous ideas that were emerging in the Arab world. The ideology facilitated the continued relevance of the PLO, whereas a stricter approach would likely have alienated potential partners and splintered the organization into non-existence. In short, an inclusive attitude led to the growth and sustainment of the movement. The drawbacks, however, were equally obvious. Arafat was under constant attack from leaders within his own organization. To them, he was not Arab enough, socialist enough, or Islamic enough. Not only did this inherent disunity foil his attempts to cement his control of the organization, but it also led to various subgroups hijacking PLO strategy. As factions sought to dominate both the headlines and the parent organization, leaders would sometimes engage in spectacular acts of terror or other violence. Arafat often found himself racing to keep up with events and trying to rein in recalcitrant colleagues. In this, he was never fully successful. An example of the opposite exclusive approach is found in the case of the Lebanese Hezbollah insurgency. Having splintered from the Amal movement in the mid-1980s, Hezbollah leaders issued a manifesto, referred to as the Open Letter, in 1985. In the manifesto, they described their ideology in crystal clear terms. They were Islamic, strongly allied with Iran, and utterly determined to reject Lebanese politics. This type of strong rhetoric appealed to their chief constituents, the impoverished, war-weary, and practically disenfranchised Shiites in the south. Bolstered by the theological convictions and edicts of a respected cleric, Sayyid Muhammad Fadlala, the energetic young insurgency attracted many recruits. But in the early 1990s, a key crossroad appeared when Hezbollah leaders had to wrestle with the question of entering the very political arena that they had previously spurned. Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, made the fateful decision to change the group's ideology in this regard. Hezbollah thereafter ran for seats in the Lebanese parliament and captured an influential sector of the government. Nasrallah reckoned that the time had come in which the insurgency, if it was to continue helping its constituents, would have to develop a legal political presence in Beirut. His decision led to the inevitable and predictable loss of some supporters whose ideological rigidity did not facilitate such maneuvers, but in the end, Hezbollah benefited from the change. Hence, in contrast to the PLO, Hezbollah began with a very exclusive ideology, but gradually expanded its appeal and influence by changing to have a more inclusive stance. Sendero Luminoso, Shining Path, the Maoist insurgency in Peru, developed an exclusive ideology rooted in the ethnic and class conflict within the country. The movement allied itself with a largely disenfranchised and impoverished indigenous population, and that ideology garnered immediate and widespread support within the local communities of the Peruvian highlands. However, this ideology did not resonate as strongly with other communities in the coastal plain or in the urban communities of Lima and other Peruvian cities. Oddly, Abimael Guzman, the leader of Sendero, chose not to reach out to other constituencies or to potential external sources of support. Instead, his ideology and that of his followers remained focused on the centrality of Guzman and the Maoist model he endorsed within Peru for addressing ethnic and class conflict. Consequently, the exclusivity of the Shining Path ideology served as a brake on the movement's progress, just as it initially helped to accelerate the movement's development in the early stages. Finally, and not surprisingly, the complete absence of a strong, unifying ideology, whether inclusive or exclusive, can severely limit the development, growth, and sustainment of an insurgency, especially when this ideological void is filled by personal motivation and ambitions. Insurgencies such as the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, the Revolutionary United Front, RUF, in Sierra Leone, and the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND, in Nigeria, all started with pseudo-ideological foundations related to government repression and government control of resources, but soon deteriorated into struggles between local insurgent leaders and their control over drug crops, diamond fields, and oil bunkering operations, respectively. In this environment, where individual aspirations usurp any strategic ideology, organizational cohesion quickly deteriorates. These examples are repeated in many modern insurgencies today because ideology remains closely wedded to a movement's ability to recruit, build partnerships, and act decisively. Ideology can be a strategic tool for flexible, adaptive leaders, or it can be a straitjacket that inhibits team building and leads to ineffective strategy. Organization. An underground must develop an effective organization in order to carry out its operational missions. An effective organization, in turn, requires the underground to perform certain essential housekeeping administrative functions, as well as operational functions. In discussing these functions in this chapter, we will enumerate the major problems likely to be faced by most undergrounds and describe alternate ways in which the problems have been handled through organization. There are no set or standardized ways to accomplish a given function. The choice and effectiveness of a given technique depends largely upon the resources available to the movement and the countermeasures used by the security force. As undergrounds adopt certain practices, the security forces invariably develop countermeasures that undermine the effectiveness of these practices. Consequently, both governments and undergrounds are constantly changing techniques and developing new ones. Moreover, the availability of resources governs the underground's choice of techniques and determines how flexible it can be in responding to government actions. Insurgencies in the modern world populate a spectrum of sophistication, from jungle tribes employing drums for communication to internet-savvy urban operatives conversant with the latest trends in science and technology. In less developed regions, the absence of legacy communication systems and the availability of significant funding from trafficking in gemstones, weapons, oil, humans, narcotics, etc., can result in insurgent groups having the ability to leapfrog over the technical capabilities of the security forces through the purchase of sophisticated equipment through either legal or black markets. Thus, the available means, participants' education level, and the nature of the government security apparatus combine to frame the underground's organizational and communication strategy. Finally, there is no single organizational structure that is best suited for an underground under all conditions. A number of major factors must be considered by those responsible for organizing the underground, and on the basis of these considerations, an organizational pattern is used that will best provide for successful accomplishment of underground functions. As stated earlier, however, competing internal interests as well as a lack of experience can often result in an initial organizational process that is ad hoc or ill-conceived. A discussion of the major factors that must be considered during organizational planning is presented here and is followed by a description of the patterns of organization that reflect critical insurgency principles. Factors determining organizational structure. Predominant strategy. Resistance and revolutionary movements operate on both political and military fronts. The choice of which front an underground will emphasize depends on the likelihood of success in one area rather than another, and on unexpected events that compel the underground to revise its predominant strategy. It may be that underground infiltration of key positions in both the government and the military is blocked, as is usually the case in resistance situations, and often the case in revolutionary ones. When it is impossible to seize the instruments of control, the underground chooses the predominantly political strategy of trying to weaken the government's effectiveness by sabotage and by subverting the people's support of the government. An underground may shift from a predominantly political strategy to one that is predominantly military because it is losing popular political support. The leaders may feel that unless they act immediately and aggressively, they may lose their last opportunity to seize power. In post-World War II Philippines, the communists were restrained from continuing their activities on the political front when they were denied access to seats in the legislature. To offset the drop in popular support created by this curtailment of their activities, they consequently turned to military action. A rapid shift to a predominantly military strategy can also occur when popular sentiment against the existing government becomes so strong that the insurgency's leadership feels that they can use this popular discontent to quickly seize power, as the communists in Greece believed after World War II. Having decided to shift primary emphasis from either the political or military front to the other, the entire underground may require major reorganization. General Voi Wen Giap reported that in Indochina, the transition from political to armed struggle caused a great change in the principles of organization and work. During the Malayan Emergency in the late 1940s, communist leaders shifted from political efforts through the organization of united fronts and infiltration of unions to the militarization phase of terrorism and guerrilla warfare. After this failed, they turned back to political activity. With each shift in strategy, various organizational units had to be organized, disbanded, or reorganized, all at no small cost to the movement. These units included escape and evasion nets for both guerrillas and underground, intelligence nets in urban areas as well as throughout the countryside, secret supply depots and supply routes, and recruiting teams for both underground and military units. In addition, attempts to transition from military to political strategies can often fail because the military success of insurgent organizations often relies on decentralized control and the independence of local field commanders, but this same independence can make it impossible to create a unified, centralized organization that is critical for the transition to a political strategy. Recent examples include the campaigns by the RUF in Sierra Leone and the MEND in Nigeria. The expected duration of the underground also has a very important effect upon its organization and its activities. Movements that are organized for a very short period of time do not usually have a complex organization, elaborate security procedures, or selective membership. Underground movements that expect to exist for several years often develop more complicated organizations and undertake a wider range of activities. The important point is that different predominant strategies will give different emphases to underground functions, and performance of these various functions in turn requires different organizational structures. Origins and leadership. Undergrounds usually develop within existing social, political, or military organizations. The underground organizer must rely on past relationships so he will not be betrayed and on the informal communication channels of organizations with which he is familiar. As a result, many undergrounds have emerged from outlawed political parties, labor organizations, civic clubs, or disbanded military organizations. This was a critical element in the Euskadi Ta Askatasuna, Basque Homeland and Freedom, or ETA, organizational structure in Spain, as it was built around the Basque institution of the cuadrilla, a group of friends of roughly the same age who spent most of their time together drinking, sharing meals, and mountain climbing, with group ties often stronger than family ties. Existing organizations can also provide the necessary structure and relationships for recruiting members for an insurgency, which was the deliberate strategy of the Hutu leadership in Rwanda when it organized tens of thousands of recently unemployed young males into soccer clubs that would eventually become the operational elements of their genocide against the Tutsis in 1994. Historically, the organizational character of the underground movement has differed according to whether the movement has its beginning in political or military organizations, and whether it was led by a political or military leader. Organizations controlled by politicians are frequently found in revolutionary warfare. Also, many of the European underground organizations of World War II developed from pre-war political parties and were directed by political leaders. Consequently, the organization reflected the influence of the political leader. On the other hand, although many resistance groups may organize spontaneously, national groups are usually sponsored and supported by external conventional military forces. Because it is usually through this military assistance that the movement gains its stature, the choice of underground leaders is influenced by their knowledge of strategy, tactics, and military affairs, and their activities are oriented toward providing aid to conventional forces. In Yugoslavia, for example, the Allied forces withdrew support from Dragoljub Mihailović and recognized and supported Marshal Josip Broz Tito during World War II because they felt he was carrying on aggressive action against the Germans and would thereby be of greater assistance to the military mission. Conversely, if the external sponsor no longer considered the insurgency to be of strategic importance to the sponsor's overall goals, it may rapidly reduce its support to the insurgency, as was the case with the Frente Farabundo Martí para la Liberación Nacional, Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, or FMLN, in El Salvador, when the critical flow of arms, money, and training from the Soviet Union was curtailed in the late 1980s, effectively dooming the insurgency. Some movements have both political and military leaders who function independently of each other. In this form of organization, the underground operates politically in the populated areas, while the guerrilla forces are led by a military man in the rural areas. This occurred in the anti-fascist resistance in Italy during World War II and in Morocco during the fight for independence, 1953 through 1955. Types of organization. Organizational structure varies with the organizational theories of the resistance or the revolutionary leaders. Mass organization. When leaders conclude that a large number of people are necessary to overcome the power of the governing authority and its instruments of force, they may opt for mass organization. Membership is open to anyone who wishes to join, and the objective is to recruit as many people as possible. For the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, LTTE, in Sri Lanka, the attempt to mobilize the entire population in the territory it controlled led it to create in 1999 a policy for a universal people's militia that would impose military training on anyone over the age of 15. One disadvantage of this organizational structure is the loose security measures associated with it. The members are usually not practiced in security precautions, and the identities of underground members are easily obtained through loose talk and careless, overt actions. However, organizations of this type have managed to minimize the threat of informers primarily through the public sympathy for the movement and through the use of terrorism, as was the case of the Provisional Irish Republican Army, PIRA, and its practice of kneecapping informants. In the early days of the Organisation de l'Armée Secrète, Organization of the Secret Army, Secret Armed Organization, or OAS, in Algeria, General Raoul Salan moved about openly, even while the French government was seeking him and had posted a reward for him. The populace was terrorized into remaining silent. Another disadvantage of this type of organizational structure is in its command and control structure. It is difficult to obtain concerted action against the governing authority, usually because of the lack of training and discipline of members. Elite organization. The theory here is that a small elite organization can make up in skill and discipline what it lacks in size, and that at the proper moment, a small militant group can accomplish more in one blow than a large mass organization can accomplish over a prolonged period of time. The membership in a movement such as this is small, and each individual is carefully screened and tested before he is permitted to join. Once a member, he is subjected to intensive training and discipline to develop the skills necessary for clandestine work. This type of organization usually works toward a coup d'etat, or revolution from the top. In a police state, where the mechanisms of internal security are extensive, this is the most common form of underground. an elite organization generally must have some condition of internal confusion, such as the assassination of the head of state or rivalry between several major political factions, before it can strike with any hope of winning. The disadvantage of this type of organization is that it must remain relatively inactive while waiting for the proper moment, and inactivity usually works against the movement because its members may lose their enthusiasm. Elite Front Organization. Communist insurgents have historically worked from this type of organizational theory. Recruitment is very selective, and the party itself does not expand rapidly. Instead, a front organization is created, or an existing organization that claims to seek some popular objective, such as liberation or independence, is infiltrated. Within the front movement, military and civilian organizations are established. Because the communists organize these groups, they are usually in leadership positions. If the movement fails, the communist underground is not damaged either organizationally or by reputation because it is the front group and not the communists who lose the insurgency. On the other hand, if they are successful, the communists are in firm control of the revolutionary organization. Conflicting needs of security and expansion. An underground operates in a hostile environment in which government forces attempt to seek it out and destroy it. In order to survive and at the same time achieve its ultimate objectives, an underground must adapt to two major factors: government countermeasures and its own successes and failures. Changes in its organization and its size depend on the effectiveness and size of the government security forces. As the government becomes more effective, the underground must emphasize security, and this usually means smaller and fewer organizational units. An underground may, after a few spectacular successes, find itself deluged with new recruits. If it fails to expand its organization quickly by relaxing security measures, it may pass up an opportunity to seize power and attain its objectives. On the other hand, if it recruits unreliable persons, a serious security leak may enable the security forces to destroy the entire organization. Alternately, rapid expansion may provide government security forces with the opportunity to infiltrate the underground. Thus, undergrounds face a dilemma of conflicting goals. In order to achieve their objectives, they must be expansive and aggressive. In order to survive, they must take precautions and emphasize security. Leaders must juggle organizational patterns and size so as to achieve an optimum balance between the need to expand and the need to maintain security. Command and control. To be effective, an underground needs concerted action. Unless it can establish a centralized command, an underground's activities occur in a haphazard manner and may lose much of their cumulative effect. For example, units may attack the same targets and draw government attention to each other. However, for security reasons, decentralization of activities is most desirable. Therefore, in practice, leaders develop a balance between centralized and decentralized command and control. Because a command echelon cannot direct each subordinate unit, it must rely on mission orders, that is, the central command issues orders describing the tactical objective and recommends activities that it believes can best accomplish the objective. Each of the subordinate units, which must place a premium on survival, can devise its own plan for carrying out the orders. Consequently, the subordinate units usually have the authority to make independent decisions on local issues and to operate autonomously with only general direction and guidance from the centralized command. When special assignments are given, the central command may send a special representative to the subordinate underground unit to supervise the attack directly. In this case, the special representative, being responsible to the central command, is usually placed in charge of the unit. The central command may not know precisely how many members belong to the subordinate units of the organization. It may test the strength of the organization by calling demonstrations, strikes, or other trial actions. Such tests provide the central command with some estimate of underground strength and ability to react without jeopardizing the identity of its members. The tests can also help the organization determine the length of time necessary to mobilize its units through the clandestine communications net, the approximate number who can be reached, and the number who ultimately participate. The underground usually specifies in great detail the transfer of authority as well as the procedure for reestablishing the chain of command in case a leader is captured. This is to ensure that the capture of an important leader will not necessarily lead to the collapse of the organization or an interruption of its activities. Centralization of administrative functions. Undergrounds that function for a prolonged period of time generally centralize many activities in the central command so that subordinate units may receive services that they could not ordinarily provide for themselves. Activities such as the production of false documents, the collection of funds, the purchase of supplies, the analysis of intelligence information, and security checks on new recruits may be better performed by a central agency. These centralized activities can best be performed outside of the country, in areas in which government security measures are lax, or in a place of sanctuary. Here, members can meet openly and discuss plans and procedures without fear of being captured or having records fall into the hands of the security forces. In Algeria, the internal command was buttressed by an external political military command that was usually in Tunisia. In the Philippines, the communists not only had an internal underground command, the Politburo in Manila, but also a Politburo out, safely located in guerrilla-held territory where much of the collating of intelligence and planning took place. The Ushtria Qlimitare e Kosovës, Kosovo Liberation Army, or KLA, in Kosovo, relied heavily on administrative support that it received from its diaspora in Germany and elsewhere. During World War II, much of this centralized activity was conducted for European governments by their governments in exile, which were located in England. Decentralization of units. The basic underground unit is the cell. The cell usually has from 3 to 7 members, one of whom is appointed cell leader and is responsible for making assignments and checking to see that they are carried out. As the underground recruits more and more people, the cells are not expanded, rather, new cells are created. The cell may be composed of persons who live in a particular vicinity or who work in the same occupation. Often, however, the individual members do not know the places of residence or the real names of their fellow members, and they meet only at prearranged times. If the cell operates as an intelligence unit, its members may never come in contact with each other. The agent usually gathers information and transmits it to the cell leader through a courier, through a mail drop, or through clandestine use of computer networks, for example, email, social media, coded websites. The cell leader may have several agents, but the agents never contact each other and only contact the cell leader through intermediaries. Lateral communications and coordination with other cells or with guerrilla forces are also carried out in this manner. In this way, if one unit is compromised, its members cannot inform on their superiors or other lateral units. To reduce the possibility of its members being discovered, the underground disperses its cells over widely separated geographic areas and groups. This extends the government security forces so they cannot concentrate on any single area or group. For example, the underground attempts to gain as wide a representation as possible among various ethnic and interest groups. The Malayan Communist Party was easy prey for security forces partly because it was almost entirely composed of indigenous Chinese. The OAS in Algeria was composed of Europeans who numbered only 1 out of every 10 inhabitants. Even more crucial for the OAS, it was centered in 3 cities, thus allowing the French to concentrate their forces. The Frente de Liberación Nacional, National Liberation Front or FLN, on the other hand, was made up of Muslims, who constituted 90% of the population and were distributed throughout the country. An underground is usually organized into territorial units. The size of the units depends on the density of the population and the number in the underground. Each territorial unit is subdivided into districts and finally into cells. Within each of these geographical districts and on each level of organization, different functions and groups responsible for those functions are represented. During the early 1990s, the FARC in Colombia organized into 7 operational regions: Northern, Caribbean, Northwestern, bordering Panama, Middle Magdalena, along the Venezuelan border, Central, Eastern, Western, and Southern, and each region had a military bloc associated with it. In addition, undergrounds have found it convenient to organize units within existing occupational activities, such as railroad workers' unions. Thus, the underground is organized by territorial units, such as state, county, city, and cell, as well as by professional and occupational groups, which transcend traditional boundaries. The underground organization and many of its activities are based upon a fail-safe principle. That is, it is organized so that if one element fails, the consequences for the total organization will be few. Almost all clandestine organizations that are susceptible to compromise by security forces have parallel organizational units and networks of units. In every case, the underground attempts to have a backup unit that can perform the same duties as the primary unit if the latter is compromised. It usually takes a long time to establish a unit or net, and the underground must plan for contingencies such as the compromise of the primary unit or increased government security measures. Thus, the organizational expansion of undergrounds is usually in a lateral direction by duplicating units and functions. The decentralization extends to all functions. The underground usually does not jeopardize intelligence units by demanding that they perform sabotage as well, because sabotage operations may draw attention to individuals and compromise their usefulness as intelligence agents. An underground organization that provides an excellent example of all of these principles and which served as a model for other insurgent movements is the Provisional IRA, PIRA. In response to increasingly effective countermeasures by the British in 1972 and swelling numbers of volunteers, the PIRA relied on a cellular structure for the organization to enhance both security and operational effectiveness. The basic cell of the organization was the Active Service Unit, ASU, which carried out the military operations of the PIRA. Usually containing 4 volunteers and 1 operations commander, the ASUs could be supported by an intelligence officer or education officer if mission planning or training were required. Each ASU was responsible for the bulk of the operational expenses as well as their safe houses and transportation. The operations commander of an ASU usually knew the identity of only one higher commander in his organization, the brigade adjutant, and the brigade adjutant took his orders from the geographical or central command above him, with the PIRA having 2 overall commands, the Northern and Southern commands. The senior echelons of the PIRA consisted of the General Army Convention, the Army Executive, the Army Council, and the General Headquarters, GHQ. Officially located in Dublin, although many staff members were located elsewhere, the GHQ was composed of approximately 50 to 60 people who provided the centralized functions of the PIRA to include finance, security, quartermaster, operations, foreign operations, training, engineering, intelligence, education, and publicity. The Army Council was a 7-member panel that usually included the GHQ Chief of Staff, the Adjutant General, the quartermaster, the Head of Intelligence, the head of publicity, and the head of finance. Meeting at least once a month, the Army Council approved all strategy, policy, and major actions of the PIRA. The Army Executive was a board of 12 very senior and experienced IRA veterans who met every 6 months to review the activities of the Army Council and who elected the 7 members of the Army Council. Members could not belong to both the Army Council and the Army Executive. According to the constitution of the PIRA, the supreme authority of the movement was the General Army Convention, which was a large body of delegates that voted on the most important issues for the PIRA, such as the declarations of peace as well as the membership of the Army Executive. The Army Convention contained 100 to 200 active volunteers, representatives for the imprisoned, all members of the Army Council, and staff members from the local brigades, the two commands, and the GHQ. Although the Constitution allowed for the Army Convention to meet every 2 years, security concerns often required delays in holding such a large gathering of members. Conclusion. The leadership and organization of the underground is perhaps the most defining feature of an insurgent or resistance movement. Analysis of the underground must focus on the movement's ideology, organizational pattern, and leadership style. The most successful insurgencies demonstrate resilient organizations whose leaders possess the flexibility and vision to evolve the movement's controlling ideology, organization, and methods of command and control.